Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. Please be advised that we will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Bladder Cancer Treatment Updates, and this is part one of Living with Bladder Cancer. And today's workshop is supported by Pfizer, and we really want to thank them for their support of this program. And we also are doing this program in partnership with the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and you'll be hearing more about that organization during the call. And now, it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And I also want to just mention a few things. We have over 126 participants on the call today. And you come from all of the United States, from urban, rural, and suburban communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Colombia, the Philippines, the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Praminder Singh. And Dr. Singh is Associate Professor of Medicine, Section Lead, Genitourinary Oncology Program, Mayo Clinic, Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona. And Dr. Singh will be addressing an overview of bladder cancer, standard of care and new treatment approaches, the role of diagnostic technologies, genomics, and precision medicine. It is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Singh.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Messner, for a very kind introduction. So I've been tasked to talk about bladder cancer, just an overview and some standard of care approaches and diagnostic technologies and precision medicine. I know this is a vast topic to discuss in 9 minutes, which I've been assigned to, but I'll try to put all this in perspective and for the audience to understand how this field is moving. So to begin with, for the audience, you know, the concept of bladder cancer, where is this cancer arising and how and why this is important for us to understand, is this cancer arises from the skin of the bladder, which is inside the bladder. We have skin outside our body. There is an inside skin which lines the interior organs of our body, including the bladder. And this skin is same as the tubes which bring the urine from the kidney down to the bladder. Those tubes have the same skin. And so when we talk about bladder cancer, we are talking about cancer arising from the skin of the bladder and these tubes going up to the center of the kidney and bringing the urine down. And so it is called urothelial cancer. And any cancer arising anywhere in this area is usually treated as if it is bladder cancer and with same strategies and same kind of treatments. When somebody gets bladder cancer, the first step is usually to make a diagnosis, which is done by a urologist who conducts a biopsy by putting a camera through the urethra up into the urinary system and taking a chunk of the tumor, which they can see. Then that biopsy tells us how aggressive the cancer is and how deep the cancer is. Based on the depth of the cancer, because since it's arising in the inside lining of the urinary system, when this cancer grows, it grows outwards into the wall of the bladder and the urinary system. As the depth of the cancer goes more deeper and deeper, so is the stage of the cancer goes up and up. And so somebody who has stage 0 or stage 1 cancer, the cancer is limited to the skin, versus somebody who has stage 2 or 3, the cancer is going deep into the muscle layer. And once it goes outside the bladder, then it becomes stage 4. So that's kind of a general overview of the staging. Now, the most newer treatment approaches in terms of diagnostic technologies which are coming along are primarily improvements in our imaging technology, which is the MRI and the CT. There are newer tools which are coming using artificial intelligence so that we can accurately stage patients when we see them for the first time. As you can understand, when we are seeing the patient first time and we are taking a piece of the tumor from the bladder, sometimes we are inaccurate in finding out the depth of the invasion of the cancer, and so then the staging becomes a challenge because the treatment recommendations are based on the stage of the cancer. So we are now deploying our AI tools to improve and make that clinical judgment more accurate. And so this is where the field is moving, and I'm working on a grant to look at MRI and newer technologies and use AI tools to make our staging more accurate. Now, once the diagnosis is made, there are now new treatment approaches which have been approved in last couple of years, which are changing the whole paradigm of bladder cancer. And so broadly speaking, these are treatment options for the early stage cancer, which is just limited to the skin of the bladder. And this is called stage 0 or stage 1 cancer. And then there are newer treatments in the more advanced stage 2 or 3 or 4 bladder cancer. Since this is a broad topic, I'm going to just cherry pick a couple of drugs just to kind of highlight how the field is moving. And then Dr. Tiwagi will be talking more on immunotherapy and its role in bladder cancer. Now, in the early stage bladder cancer, just to touch on, I'm sure most of us in the audience may have heard about BCG, which is the vaccine used for tuberculosis way back, is now used for treating patients with bladder cancer and has been used for the last 30, 40 years. By putting that BCG in the bladder, it would induce an immune response which would kind of take away the bladder cancer. Now, there are now improvements in that strategy where we have now approved newer viruses which are genomically altered, and these viruses can go in. We can instill these viruses into patients with bladder cancer. These viruses will then go and attach to the cancer cells and then trigger an immune response for our immune cells to come in and try to kill these viruses, but in the process killing the cancer cell. This is a very simplified explanation of how these new medicines work. One of them is nadofaragene, which has been approved by FDA already. And then there is a new one which is coming, cretostimogene, which is showing very good responses. It's also an adenovirus and will likely get approved for patients with bladder cancer. Both these medicines kind of work through different pathways, but the idea is to throw in viruses into the bladder, inducing immune response, trying to kill the cancer. From a patient point of view, things to understand is how many times they have to come in to get these treatments, and that could impact their lifestyle, their visits to the clinic, and also the cost of these medicines being factored into, as it will lead to higher cost of care. Now, moving on to the advanced disease patients, where now there is a newer technology of chemotherapy, because patients are always concerned about chemotherapy and side effects. Researchers are working on developing newer ways to deliver the drug to the cancer cells. So there is a new drug called enfortumab vedotin, which has been approved for the last couple of years, but now is showing more activity when we combine it with immunotherapy. How this medicine works is that there is a protein on the surface of cancer cells, which we have identified is expressed on bladder cancer cells. We developed an antibody, which is a protein, which goes and attached to the protein expressed on the cancer cells and is carrying a chemotherapy molecule on its tail. And so having that drug delivered directly to the cancer cell. So then it claims that we can achieve higher levels of chemotherapy in the cancer cell, killing those cells, and also maybe reducing side effects which would have occurred otherwise if we would have just given the chemotherapy. This medicine is highly effective and is changing how our patients' clinical outcomes are getting better. The drug is now getting approved in earlier lines of therapy and will likely get approved in even before bladder cancer surgeries in early stage 2 and 3 in near future. So a very promising drug which is coming for our patients and when combined with immunotherapy. And the last piece in the last couple of minutes I want to touch upon before I finish is the newer precision medicine technology which is coming for bladder cancer is something called a circulating tumor DNA. In this is a fascinating technology where what we do is when the urologist takes the specimen from the bladder for your cancer, we have the ability to read the DNA transcript of the cancer cells. Once we read that, we can figure out which of the genes are having mutations in that patient. Then we can look for those alterations or mutations in the patient's blood. Because this is tumor-informed, which means we have taken patient's tumor and we looked into patient's mutation pattern, and then we are looking for the same mutations patterns in the blood, this test becomes very, very specific and sensitive for detecting cancer in patient's body. So then, so much so that at any time point, if we see this test to be positive, which means we are detecting circulating tumor DNA in the blood, it can lead to poor clinical outcomes, which tells us as physicians that we may have to be a little bit more aggressive with that set of patients in terms of treatment options. Or on the other side, if we are not detecting, maybe we can take some aggressive treatments away from the patient, so reducing toxicity. So very exciting times for our bladder cancer patients with these new drugs and newer technologies which are coming, and they are going to redefine how we see our patients and how they see their clinical outcomes, and also how we follow these patients on surveillance after treatment. So I'll stop there. Thank you so much, and I'm here for questions at the end of the session.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Singh. That was just a wonderful presentation, stellar. And actually, you're the first speaker on the program, so you've really set the stage for this program. So I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Karine Tawiji, and Dr. Tawiji is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology, Oncology, Genitourinary Oncology, University of Illinois in Chicago. And Dr. Tawiji will address updates on clinical trials, how research increases treatment options, targeted treatments, predicting response to treatment, the emerging role of immunotherapy, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Tawiji.
Thank you so much for the introduction and a great overview to start us off for this webinar today. So as far as the first topic that I'm going to dive into, and I'll be happy to answer any questions at the end, the first topic is updates on clinical trials and how research increases treatment options. So clinical trials are research studies that test new ways to prevent, detect, or treat cancer. So every medicine, surgery, or treatment that we use in bladder cancer today first went through a clinical trial to make sure that it was both safe and effective. So it's always important to ask your providers if there are any clinical trials that you may be eligible for. And when you hear things regarding updates from clinical trials, it means that researchers have found new information, such as a new drug is working better than the old standard, or perhaps we have a treatment that causes fewer side effects. And so these results can expand the number of treatment options that we have available to patients. So we're constantly moving the needle in terms of where we started as far as what was approved in bladder cancer, how well patients are living with these treatments, how long they're living with these treatments. And so clinical trials are the way that we're able to improve upon all of these things. So, for example, if a trial shows that a new therapy works well for certain patients, it may eventually become approved and offered more widely. We often wait once trial data is released for the FDA to approve those regimens so that we can get it approved by insurance. And it essentially adds more choices that are more precise for patients to have more specific treatments to their cancer type. So in short, clinical trials are how cancer care keeps improving, and they give patients access to promising new treatments and help doctors learn what works best for each person in the most specific way for their cancer type. So we strongly encourage, you know, all patients to be considered for clinical trials when it is an option at their site, because this is the way that we are expanding our treatment options beyond traditional chemotherapy. And so Dr. Singh highlighted a lot of newer treatments that have become available in the last few years as a result of patients enrolling on clinical trials and showing that these new treatments were better than our old standards. And so although there are still many roles in which chemotherapy is widely used in bladder cancer, we are also moving forward beyond traditional chemotherapy. And like Dr. Singh explained, you know, traditional chemotherapy is what you might think of that can cause nausea or hair loss, and we have a lot more specific treatments identifying different markers specific to bladder cancer or specific to an individual's bladder cancer if they express, for example, a specific flag that we can target directly. And so we know that we have a lot of, you know, more personalized, less toxic treatment options as a result of clinical trials bringing some of these effective therapies. And one of these has been, you know, the emerging role of immunotherapy. And so I know Dr. Singh highlighted a lot of the treatments that are available in bladder cancer. And I will highlight immunotherapy in a little bit more detail. So if you think of chemotherapy as the classic oldest cancer treatment that we have available in terms of things that can be given IV or by pill, we have a lot of newer treatments that can be more specific and potentially have less side effects and have better responses. So the way that immunotherapy works and the way that I explain it to patients is that it's a type of cancer treatment that helps your own immune system recognize and fight cancer cells. So normally you may think of your immune system if you have an infection, like a viral infection or a bacterial infection. Our immune system protects us from these infections and recognizes that they are foreign and don't belong there. But cancer cells are smart and they find ways to hide from our immune system. So the way that immunotherapy works, it takes the brakes off the immune system by boosting it so that it can see the cancer and attack it. So the benefit is that we can have our own immune system fighting the cancer cells. And one of the side effects of immunotherapy to be aware of is it can cause immune reactions in virtually any organ in the body, but very rarely in a very serious way. Most patients can tolerate immunotherapy very well with minimal side effects, but we certainly want to counsel patients in terms of possible side effects that they might expect and the most common ones that they can expect. Not everyone's cancer cells respond to immunotherapy, so, you know, regardless of the type of cancer therapy that's necessary, we monitor to make sure that each patient is on the right treatment that's giving them, you know, the best response possible. The other thing to mention as far as targeted treatments, and I know Dr. Singh highlighted some of these things, but we have a lot of targeted therapies, meaning we look to see if someone's cancer cells expresses a specific flag. So some of those flags are things called FGFR2 or 3. There are different proteins that are expressed by the cancer cells. And we know that we have different cancer treatments that can attack those flags on the cancer cells directly, offering us a more specific treatment. We also know that we have other markers that we're looking for, so things like HER2. And, you know, your doctor will make sure, depending on the stage of the cancer, that those things are checked for so that if there is an option of giving more precise treatment according to the approvals, that we can absolutely give those more specific treatments. And then the last point that we're going to talk about are guidelines to prepare for telehealth or telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. So I think it's really important if you are able to do a telehealth visit with your provider that you make sure that you have access to a device with a webcam and stable internet and that you try to test the connection audio and video in advance if possible. So I think it's important to make sure you have the right apps or software downloaded and to log in 10 to 15 minutes before the visit if possible. Regardless of if your visit is in person or via telehealth, it's really important to have a prepared list of questions. So So we just talked about clinical trials and the importance of them. I think that is a great question to ask when you're meeting your new care team. It's also important to ask about next line options if your current treatment were to not work or stops working, and to ask about personalized treatments based on different biomarkers or those specific proteins or flags that we talked about. It's also important to prepare lists of questions regarding treatment goals, whether the possibility of a cure is there or whether it's a palliative intent, meaning we're going to try to prolong someone's life, but we know that we can't cure the cancer. And then it's really important to ask about expected side effects, the monitoring schedule, and the logistics of labs and imaging follow-up. And finally, it's really important to also ask about symptom management and supportive care resources, whether the symptoms are symptoms related to the bladder cancer itself, whether they're related to areas where the bladder cancer could have spread, or whether they're related to other medical problems that someone might have that might be affected by the cancer treatment, and including social support, you know, in terms of communities such as this one, emotional support, all of that. It's extremely important to see what resources are available to a patient while they're going through their bladder cancer treatment. And then as far as open notes after visit access, you know, you can review a clinician's notes after the visit to confirm the understanding. And it's important to take notes to track recommendation, results, and follow-up plans. And you can use this to note any discrepancies and plan clarifying questions for your next visit. And then I would also make sure that whether you're in person or virtually, to have an up-to-date medication list and any test results handy, and consider having a caregiver or a family member join in on the call if possible. It's always helpful to have a second pair of eyes and ears. And write down new symptoms, side effects, and response to treatments in the last visit. But I think, you know, telehealth visits are a great way to minimize back and forth to the cancer clinic if possible, and it's important to take notes and use some of the tips that we just talked about. So that concludes my section, and I'll be happy to answer any questions at the end. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Tawichi. That was just a wonderful presentation. Very comprehensive, very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Just excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Stephanie Berg, and Dr. Berg is instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School, genitourinary oncologist, Lank Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Berg will be addressing communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Berg.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon, and thank you for coming on today, and I've really learned a lot from my first two colleagues. So this is a little bit of a change in more how we can communicate with us, your healthcare team, and what really quality of life means in bladder cancer care. So just as an introduction, what I tell my patients and what we talk about is quality of life can really encompass physical, emotional, social, and functional well-being. So it's really important that there's open conversations with your healthcare team to help tailor this and your priorities, meaning what is quality of life? Is it physical comfort? Is it pain, fatigue, or urinary symptoms? Is it emotional well-being, stress, depression, anxiety, social functioning, your family and work life, and your daily activities, self-care, your hobbies, and mobility? As we learned, when you go through a diagnosis and treatment, these are a lot of things that we don't really talk about right in the beginning because there's a lot going on, but it really is important to learn how to bridge these topics with your team. And why does this matter in bladder cancer? We know that these treatments can affect continence, energy, and your body image. They can really, you know, having early discussions with your team can prompt early interventions and support. So what I think, you know, when I tell my team as well here and with our patients when they come to Dana-Farber is we really want to reflect on your goals and your concerns. We think having a symptom diary can be really important and talking about that with your team. And as Dr. Tawagi mentioned, having family members or friends join you during visits is really important. and keeping lists. I mean, sometimes, you know, you can even ask to record visits or, you know, have lists coming in to talk to your team members about what's going on. Having statements, as my topic was about communication, using, you know, I've been feeling, you know, I statements, be really specific on what you describe, how intense your symptoms are, and then prioritizing what your issues are as well. You know, our visits are quite short sometimes, but, you know, making sure that you can ask appropriately how you feel. Open-ended questions, I think, are really important, you know, to help and discuss with your provider. Because remember, in oncology, it's not just your oncologist, you know, your physician. There's also a nurse navigator, there's a social worker, there's a physical therapist, there's your pharmacist, you know, there's the infusion nurse. There's a lot of people that are involved with your care. So it's important that they all have a role in these discussions and what we can provide for you. And keeping in mind that shared decision-making is something we value very highly in oncology, where we review our treatments and we support you and your family with your options and how this can impact you, this quality of life I discuss, where everyone can be, as we, you know, mentioned prior, aligning on the same page about your values and what is going to happen during your treatments and what can be offered and what you can expect to happen. Because I think there's a lot of ifs and whats, and it's nice to know that your team is there for you and that you can be comfortable asking them these questions during your visits and further discussions. So that's my few minutes on that topic, and I'm happy to take questions afterwards and more about how we can best have these communications moving forward. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Berg. That was just an excellent, stellar presentation and really focusing on quality of life concerns, which is so important. And you certainly were able to identify a lot of issues that confront people living with bladder cancer and their caregivers. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during our Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBake EVA Medical Center. And she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in just your tolerance to treatment, but providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Your diet might be modified during or even after your cancer treatment just to assist with managing side effects. Some of the potential side effects you might experience include things like diarrhea, constipation, maybe a change in taste or smell, potentially nausea or vomiting, maybe even a decreased appetite. But during your course of treatment, communicating with your healthcare team is fundamental. We're here to support you, and a dietitian is part of your healthcare team. If you're not able to meet your nutrition goals, it may result in a delay in treatment, and a dietitian can help along the way to ensure that you feel comfortable and understand your nutrition needs and how to modify your diet to improve your intake throughout your treatment. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. And so nutrition is essential. It helps build muscle. It helps keep energy going for you throughout the day. Your hydration helps combat side effects and such as constipation, maybe headaches and other signs of dehydration that can happen. There are medications to help with side effects, and so understanding how to use those is very important. Talk with your healthcare team as symptoms arise so they can help you sooner rather than later. If you're experiencing any specific challenges with foods that you're eating, talk with your dietitian. They might be able to give you some other alternatives, or it might just be something that you eliminate during a period of time. Maintaining your hydration is so important, and dehydration can increase some of the side effects such as nausea, fatigue, headaches, making you feel dizzy. A fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, juice. A general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. So some treatments might increase this fluid need or decrease it. Just talk with your healthcare team to know your unique needs. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team, and the dietitian is one of them. So please know how to reach us and know how to connect with us sooner rather than later. Thank you so much for letting me be part of today's workshop. I'll pass the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a wonderful presentation. Just a superb presentation, and thank you so much. It's so important for our participants to hear what you had to say. So, excellent. Okay, and our next speaker is Ms. Patricia Rios, and Ms. Rios is Senior Education Advocacy Manager, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and Ms. Rios will be addressing the free national programs and services of the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, BCAN, and we'll also describe their website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rios.
Greetings to all. Thank you so much for the introduction and to Cancer Care for putting together this important program. As the Senior Education Advocacy Manager for BCAN, or the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, I'm excited to talk about the free resources we have for patients and caregivers. For those who are not familiar with BCAN, we are a community united in support of people impacted by bladder cancer. We aim to provide educational and support services, from information about clinical trials available in your community, to webinars, printed materials, a designated podcast, to a treatment matrix. You can find these and much more on our website at bcan.org. Again, that is bcan.org. On our website, we also have a listing of various bladder cancer support groups, including our monthly female-focused support group, which meets virtually the first Tuesday of the month. For anyone looking to speak to someone who has gone through a similar bladder cancer experience, our peer-to-peer program called Survivor to Survivor matches bladder cancer patients and caregivers with trained volunteers who share insight about their own experience with bladder cancer. And for everyone listening today, I encourage you to download a copy of our easy-to-read Bladder Cancer Basics Handbook directly from our website to have it handy as you navigate your journey. I will conclude by sharing that in 2003, BCAN partnered with Cancer Care to launch a toll-free support line for bladder cancer patients and caregivers. The support line is staffed by oncology social workers from Cancer Care who can provide emotional and practical support as well as help find the various resources I listed. The support line can be accessed by calling 833-275-4222. It is staffed Monday through Thursday between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and Fridays between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. That number again is 833-275-4222. I will now turn the mic back to Dr. Center.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Rios. That's just wonderful, and it's so wonderful to have this toll-free number with BCAN and Cancer Care. And thank you for providing the phone number and information. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And I just want to make a few comments about Cancer Care's free national programs and services. Cancer Care is a national organization, and we provide practical, financial, and co-payment assistance. We also have a number of online support groups. We have, of course, these Connect Education workshops, about 60 or 70 a year. And we also have free publications that you can access. And you can access our helpline at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And now, we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to describe to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Thank you. So this question for Dr. Singh. Now that there are targeted treatments for bladder cancer, depending on its mutations, why the hesitancy here? Genomic testing should be as routinely ordered for bladder cancer, regardless of the stage, just as done in most other cancers. Could you address this question, Dr. Singh?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Messner. This is actually a very good question. So for the general audience, I'm just going to give a little bit of background on this. So the question is why genomic testing is not done routinely for all stages of the bladder cancer, and since it's only done for stage 4 cancer. The reason behind is that we have one drug called erdafitinib, which is approved for patients who have an FGFR3 alteration, which is a kind of a gene, fibroblast growth factor receptor gene, which is altered, and that makes this tumor susceptible to this medication called erdafitinib. Now, the erdafitinib was tested in advanced disease patients who have progressed after receiving one or two lines of therapy, including chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And so based on the approval, the drug is only approved for patients with stage 4, and thus the genomic testing goes along with that when we have to decide regarding the choice of the treatment. Now, the drug and or similar drugs with similar actions are already being tested. As Dr. Tawagi mentioned, clinical trials, there are clinical trials happening at earlier stage 0-1 disease and stage 2 disease, where we are looking for activity and efficacy of this drug in earlier stage disease. And I expect if the drug is proven to be effective in the earlier stage disease, then it will become a norm to do genomic testing at all stages of bladder cancer. There are certain patients where there are cancers within the bladder or urinary system which could run in families. So there is something called as a Lynch syndrome, where we go above and beyond, and if we have a certain history in the family, then we can request genomic testing. But at this time, genomic testing is more widely accepted in later stages like stage 4 disease and not so much in the earlier stage disease. And that is just because of the approval of the drugs in that stage. I hope I answered that question.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Tawashi. Are cancer vaccines being explored as a means of treatment?
Yes, they absolutely are. So that has been an area of interest in a lot of different cancers, particularly in melanoma. There isn't, technically, BCG has had a role in bladder cancer for a long time now, in the early stage bladder cancer, and then we've had other gene therapies that have been approved in non-muscle invasive, so like the early stage bladder cancer. At this point, there is not any role of bladder cancer vaccines in more advanced disease, so when it spreads to that muscle layer or when it's metastatic. But there is a lot of interest as far as, bladder cancer vaccines in this space and also just in general in other areas of cancer, including things like melanoma.
Thank you so much. And a question from Ms. Rios. Could you talk more about the BCAN think tank?
Absolutely. Our think tank meeting, which is held once a year, it is a medical meeting that brings together the key opinion leaders, researchers in the field of bladder cancer, to discuss many issues related to opportunities and innovation around bladder cancer therapies and opportunities for collaboration. It is a meeting that takes place usually around August, and we are thrilled to have celebrated our 19th meeting this year, and it's an invite-only meeting, but we'd love to share more information about that. For that, it's available on our website at bcan.org.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Berg. What forms of palliative care would you recommend to patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer?
So I think when we talk about anybody that's diagnosed with muscle invasive, palliative or supportive care could be really important, especially if they're going for a surgery afterwards, because meaning their bladder removed. That would be really important about symptoms after that and how to manage an ileal conduit or a neobladder. In addition, if they're doing a bladder sparing, there can be some complications and support needed for care after radiation. And in general, chemotherapy, if they're requiring that and it's recommended by their team. So I believe it's a wonderful idea to use that type of team, if available, to discuss what symptoms can be controlled outside when they're getting those types of treatments. So it's always a great avenue as well to start off with your care team at your center that you're treated at.
And thank you so much. And another question from our participants, and this would be for Dr. Singh. How can treatment affect my fertility as a woman? If surgery becomes my only option, is it possible that I could lose some of my reproductive organs? How can I prevent this or preserve fertility?
So this is a very important area of investigation. Beacon had a full session a few years ago on preserving sexual function in patients with bladder cancer. And depending upon patient is a male or female, having bladder cancer surgery could have a significant impact on the sexual quality of life and the fertility of the patient. So, for example, in women, if we remove the bladder, at that time the patient may end up losing the uterus and the other organs in the pelvis, and that was what it was traditionally done. Now, surgeons, especially at Johns Hopkins and other high-volume centers like Mayo Clinic, they are investigating if they can just remove the bladder and try to preserve the uterus and the ovaries in women to help preserve their sexual function. And on the other side, in men, when they lose their bladder, they end up losing their prostate and seminal vesicles, and that could impact their ability to have sexual function. One context is that this cancer occurs in older patients where fertility may be less impacted, but now we see young patients also getting bladder cancer, so this is an area of active interest in research and in investigation, and we are looking closely into how we can help preserve function. It is advised to have a conversation with a fertility expert as they go in, a younger patient is going in, or a patient who is interested in preserving fertility, at least have a conversation with them to see what are the options available to them, or talk to your surgeon if they can do a organ-preserving bladder surgery to help maintain fertility. So, yes, it's an important area of investigation.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Excellent. Question and excellent answer. Thank you. And another question for Dr. Tavisi. Why is not genomic testing being utilized for treatment decisions at every stage of bladder cancer? Natera offers an excellent package in its Altera test tumor genomic profile They have an excellent financial aid program. Could you comment on that?
Why is it not being offered at every stage?
Yes.
So I think it's really, the data here is really evolving in terms of the use of ctDNA across the stages of bladder cancer. So we've heard a lot more information as far as the utility of using ctDNA in the perioperative space, meaning for patients with localized bladder cancer that may need surgery or end up having chemotherapy and radiation and preserve their bladder, we're increasingly using ctDNA. It's not approved per guidelines yet. And then in the metastatic space and then also in the non-muscle invasive space, it's still exploratory in some levels, but we're having increasing levels of evidence to support its use. So I think it's really provider dependent at this point whether to order it or not outside of a clinical trial. We know, you know, based on data that we've seen, that it's predictive but not prognostic, but we're getting more and more information on this. So I do think that, you know, in the years to come, it may be incorporated in our guidelines as far as, you know, being ordered for every patient. But that being said, if you're seeing your provider and they're not ordering it, I would definitely ask them if that's something that they could do for you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And the last question for Dr. Berg. What is your position on using tumor genetics on the original bladder cancer, regardless of stage in treatment decision making?
So in urothelial cancer, I think compared to others, there is more what we, you know, the availability of what we can test and what we can biopsy as oncologists. And especially as how we've discussed with all of us, there is an evolution of diagnosis for men and women that have it not invading into the muscle, invading into the muscle and beyond. So typically, we prefer specimens, meaning the tissue of someone, to be closest to what level we're trying to treat as possible due to the preservation of the specimen, the utility of how a institution or a company runs your test. But often, you know, a lot of these genes that make up one's cancer persist amongst your diagnosis. And as mentioned prior by Dr. Tawagi and Dr. Singh, it can be prudent to repeat these tests if there is maybe a new treatment available, a clinical trial available that perhaps you didn't have that marker. But often we just try to get whatever is appropriate in the beginning. So that could be something from a year ago or maybe a few years ago versus a more recent diagnosis. So it is dependent on, you know, what is available and what your care team thinks would be the most helpful in sending that test out and what that company can actually do with that or your institution can do with those results. So it can be varied. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. And question for Dr. Singh, is BCG still the best first course of action for high-grade NMIBC?
So very good question. For the audience, NMIBC, because I didn't use that term before, is the stage 0 or 1 cancer, which is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And as I had alluded to, that BCG is put inside the bladder to help control the cancer. And it has been a very effective therapy for last over 4 decades. Recently, data has been presented about a new immunotherapy drug, sensolimab, which is similar to what Dr. Tawagi had explained before, in combination with BCG, and the trial was positive for improved outcomes. There is a baggage of side effects which come along with any new intervention. And so we have to see how FDA will look at that data and if they will approve the medication in combination with BCG, and putting things in perspective of, and how clinicians will look at that if the risk or side effects is too high, would it become a clinical practice? It is to be seen. But at this time, as of today, BCG is the best and the only approved as a first line. But then there is now data on clinical trials to show there is a step up which is coming, and we are looking forward to FDA's decision on it.
Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Berg. What are the genetics and familial risk of this cancer, the bladder cancer?
So that's an important question, because one thing that we really emphasize for urothelial cancer for genetic risks is if one is diagnosed, which we didn't talk a lot about today, something called upper tract urothelial cancer. And that is something where genetic testing in the familial sense, meaning inherited from your parents and grandparents, is a syndrome called Lynch syndrome. And that's a very important cancer syndrome. So anyone diagnosed with an upper tract cancer, which is a bladder cancer, but in your ureter, which is the tube that connects your bladder to your kidney, and those are the similar cells, like Dr. Singh mentioned, of that bladder skin that go all the way up, that's very important to get that, what we call germline or familial testing for Lynch syndrome. Otherwise, a family history is very important to follow, because it can be inherited, but it is not as likely as a prostate or a breast cancer, where we know these can pass down through certain genes inherited by family members. But otherwise, it's always important to do that, because especially if you're someone who's, you know, less than the age of 50, diagnosed with a bladder cancer, that is unusual, but it can happen. So we would recommend, you know, seeing a genetics team and a genetic counselor through your center. Do not do anything online. Please always go through a counselor in your center to get that type of testing done, because if it is abnormal, having a professional review that with you and understand it is extremely important.
Excellent. Thank you. And now I want to thank our speakers, and I want to thank our participants. And I also now would like to move on to takeaways. So I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway to each of you. I'm going to start with Dr. Singh, just a takeaway.
Yeah, so thank you so much again for having me here. And so the key takeaway from my part of the talk is that there are exciting times for our bladder cancer patients. There are multiple new drugs at early stage bladder cancer which are getting approved or are already approved recently. They are going to redefine how patients are treated at early stage, and patients may require less cystectomies because these new medications can control the cancer at early stage. We have new treatments for advanced disease setting, for new delivery systems to deliver chemotherapy more effectively to the cancer cells and improve outcomes. And then we have new tools, including ctDNA, as some of the members in the audience also pointed out to. Natera at this time is helping us prognosticate patients better, and may in future also help predict who is going to respond better, as there are newer trials which are coming out, including this test as part of their testing in the clinical trial, and so we'll redefine how we take care of our patients. So very exciting times for our patients, and with that, I'll pass on to Dr. Tawaji.
Good, thank you. Dr. Tawaji, your takeaway?
Absolutely. I think some of the takeaways, echoing what Dr. Singh said, is we are, you know, as patients enroll in clinical trials and we're able to have better, more precise treatment, we are having better outcomes, less toxicity. So I highly encourage, you know, every patient to inquire about clinical trials at their institution so we can continue to improve that. And I also highly encourage, you know, having an extra set of ears and eyes at your visit. Take notes, bring a notepad, and don't hesitate to reach out for any things that you may not have understood that your care team explained.
And Dr. Tweedy, this is a last-minute question for one of our participants. Is bladder cancer hard to diagnose?
So bladder cancer isn't one of the cancers for which we have routine screening, such as, you know, mammograms for breast cancer or even for prostate cancer. We have a discussion about getting blood tests. So bladder cancer is generally diagnosed when patients present with symptoms. So it can be harder to diagnose, you know, particularly for women if they have recurrent urinary tract infections. That's a reason to sort of investigate into other causes, including a workup for bladder cancer. And both for men and women, you know, having urinary symptoms that are not going away, whether it's burning when you pee, blood in the urine, pelvic pain, things like that, can prompt talking to your, you know, primary care provider and seeing about getting referred to urologists for further investigation. In the more advanced stages, sometimes it can present with symptoms where the cancer has spread. So in general, it can be, you know, a little bit harder to diagnose, but I think, you know, if something is unusual, it's always important to talk to your doctor.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Dr. Berg, your takeaway?
So, yes, and thank you again for everybody. My big takeaway would be that I always say to patients, you know, your voice guides your care, right? So you need to keep the dialogue open with your team, and your team isn't just your physician, it's your dietitian, your pharmacy team, your nursing team, the scheduling team, you know, there's a whole team that we communicate with, and just keep those conversations ongoing about how you feel and what quality, and as I said earlier, for your care. So that's my takeaway. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And Ms. Rios?
Yes. My takeaway for the audience is to remind everyone that Beacon is here to support you along the way. I know a lot of this information can seem overwhelming and can be complex to navigate at times. And that is why resources such as this call are so vital to help us understand. But to remember that our website, bcin.org, is available 24/7 to you to be able to read up on many of the key words and topics that you heard today and to assist you as you're navigating this journey.
Thank you so much. I want to thank all of our speakers, and I also want to thank our participants who asked such really great questions as well. It's a stellar program. We have done this program before, but I have to say today's program we had more questions than ever before. We couldn't take all of the questions, but we had more questions than ever before, and our speakers were just phenomenal. So thank you to all. And I do want to make a few comments before I conclude the program. You know, both BCAN is your place to go in terms of for bladder cancer. It's the only national nonprofit organization that exists for bladder cancer, so definitely it's a great organization, a go-to organization. And we will be sending you all the information that we provided in terms of how to reach you know, the bladder cancer advocacy organization. You'll definitely do that. And I want to make a few comments. You know, you've learned a lot today. So although many of you got to ask your question of the doctors today, for those of you who didn't get to, for those of you who got to ask your questions of the doctors, go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them the same questions. Remember, you learned a lot today. So you've learned a lot. So you basically, you know, you now have a lot of information that you may not have had before. Also, for those of you who didn't get to ask your question or in queue to ask a question, please take your question to your healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best. They have all your medical records. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.